In the spring of 1942, over 120,000 Japanese Americans, men, women, and children, were evicted from their homes on the West Coast and herded into internment camps surrounded by barbed wire, searchlights, watchtowers, and armed guards. The camps were set up by Executive Order No. 9066, signed by President Franklin Roosevelt, on the premise that Japanese Americans constituted a threat to the security of the United States during its war with Japan, following the attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941. The internment lasted for 3 years. Although World War I set into motion the internment process, the seeds of anti-Japanese hostility had been planted long before on the West Coast, nearly 100 years before the first shot was ever fired in our war with Japan. Now, nearly 40 years after this chapter in American history, some Japanese Americans are demanding reparations for the time they and their parents spent in the West Coast camps. We're going to spend the first part of Fresh Air today with the Honorable William Maritani, who was a judge in the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia. He and his family were sent to an internment camp from their home near Seattle, Washington. He's very active in the Japanese American Citizen League and their National Committee for Redress, and has testified at hearings for reparations which have been held in Washington and Los Angeles. Judge Maritani is also commissioner on the Commission of Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. Welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you for coming here.
Not at all. My pleasure.
The camps which were set up seem to have been a reaction to Pearl Harbor and to the war that the United States was getting engaged in with Japan. But there is an earlier history of hostility directed towards Japanese Americans on the West Coast. Can you briefly discuss that history?
Well, that comes under the general category of what might be called yellow peril. They called it yellow peril. Incidentally, that term yellow peril itself is a loaded term because let me try out white peril. I mean, you know, is anybody in favor of white peril? And it hosted first upon the Chinese when the Chinese came during the gold rush in the mid-1800s. And when they first came in, their episodes of lynchings in California, drunken miners going on a rampage, and generally brutalizing the Chinese workers in California. And then after they tired of that, and they started to clamp down on the Chinese, then they started to import Japanese to be laborers. And then this yellow peril, racism, was transposed over onto the Japanese, and they were considered threats. And some ridiculous stories appear in the books and in some congressional testimony about the Japanese taking over all the farmlands. And, you know, they were relegated to the arid areas that nobody else wanted.
Well, there was quite a bit of exclusionist sentiment directed towards both the Chinese Americans and the Japanese Americans. The Chinese population did ultimately diminish quite a bit, whereas the Japanese population didn't. Is there an explanation for that or a reason for that?
No. Generally, our immigration laws were anti-Asian. In 1924, for example, all immigration from Japan, from Asia in general, was prohibited to the United States. Yes, there was a great deal of racism directed toward people of the yellow race in the United States. For example, it may come as news to you that it wasn't only the blacks who were placed in segregated schools. There were segregated schools in San Francisco for Orientals, for example. My parents were not allowed to own land. They were not allowed, at one point in our history, Orientals were not allowed to testify in American courtrooms. And so the parallel with a black experience is very similar in many, many ways. It wasn't as long, of course, because the blacks ran into problems beginning in 1619. But there are many, many parallels.
Did those parallels foster any sympathy between Orientals and blacks as, you know, oppressed minorities in America?
No, I don't think so, because each of us was involved in trying to survive and not worrying so much about the other, trying to survive ourselves.
Well, what were some of the early signs of what was to come in the 40s to Japanese Americans? I mean, there was obviously a heritage of a hostility, but when could you tell that things were really getting more serious?
Oh, I could tell that ever since I was in elementary school myself.
What do you remember from that?
Having to fight in the schoolyard against racial epithets constantly. I remember even in college when I was vice president of the student senate, there were certain duties I was supposed to undertake as vice president, and those were denied to me. I remember that very distinctly. Those are not healthy signs for an American. As I mentioned to you before, our parents could not own land. Our parents could not gain fishing licenses, for example, denied many, many things. Also, when I saw fellow Nisei, that Nisei is a Japanese American, that means second generation. When Japanese Americans, for example, got college degrees as an architect and could not get a job, had college degrees as engineers and could not get a job in California, and I'm not from California, when they got teaching certificates, were not permitted to teach in the California schools. In other words, many areas of employment were not only made difficult, they were banned to us.
How about on movies or... I saw a cartoon once, a Popeye cartoon called Scrap the Japs,
yes,
which came out around the, the war, and it was like really quite obviously, racist depiction.
Oh yes.
What are some of your memories of that type of thing?
Sure. I remember seeing the same cartoons myself. You see, what cartoons do and movies do as well, and there are many movies, by the way, spawned during that period of time which purportedly show disloyalty by the Japanese Americans at the time of Pearl Harbor or preceding it. Incidentally, along that line, I want to make it clear that the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, reported that there was not a single incident of sabotage, espionage, etc. For example, there's a story circulating that at the time of Pearl Harbor, the sugarcane fields were cut in certain ways so that the arrow pointed to Pearl Harbor. Well, my goodness, if you can't find Pearl Harbor without an arrow pointing in a sugarcane field, that's ridiculous. And, of course, that's totally untrue. These are the kinds of things I experienced. One of the things, incidentally, about cartoons and so on, racism, the first step in racism is you dehumanize your victims. You do not make them human beings. You do not make them people like you and me and other Americans. This is epitomized, incidentally, most recently by our pogroms, and let's call a spade a spade, what we did in Vietnam, some of the brutality. You don't kill Vietnamese, you kill gooks, and I don't know what a gook is, or a slope. You see, you first dehumanize them, you make them non-human, and then you are prepared to brutalize them.
Did cartoons or were the TV shows of the day, were they doing that?
You know, buck teeth. Do you see me with buck teeth, and I'm a full-blooded Japanese in terms of blood? You wear big glasses, squinty-eyed, so forth. Let's assume they are. So what? That's the way God made them, if that's the way they were made. And of course, they're not all like that.
How about bad comedians doing Jap impressions?
Sure. Bob Hope used to do it. I don't think he did it with any venal thought in mind, but that's part of the milieu or the culture, and you just dehumanize. For example, there used to be in the black scene, Step and Fetch It, the soft shoe, lazy black. Then we had, even here in Philadelphia, the black parody on the blacks in the Mummers Parade until the blacks protested. These are the kinds of things that hosted upon Japanese Americans. You make a parody of them.
Now, did this take a sudden turn?
Oh, no. It was ongoing. And all it did is continue to accelerate.
Did you react differently to things like this than your parents did? Was there any generational differences?
I think so, very definitely. I think my parents were much more patient than I was. Remember, I was born and raised as an American, hated the things Americans hate, loved the things Americans hate, laughed at the things Americans laughed at, just like any other American. So when I saw these indignities as an American, I reacted as an American, and I despised them.
Okay, now on February 19th, 1942... President Roosevelt signed the Executive Order 9066, which led to the internment. What happened, though, after he signed it? What was the process? How did you find out what was going to happen? And what did you do next?
All right. At that time, by the way, going back and reconstructing it from today's perspective, we know now that President Roosevelt signed that at the insistence of the military. We also know that within 2 weeks, I think it was, General John L. DeWitt in the Western Defense Command set up the machinery for what ultimately led to the uprooting of the Japanese Americans. In other words, to use a street slang phrase, the skids were greased. Everything was all set up. This was not a sudden impulse thing. I learned about it when finally the order came out that you've got to leave my hometown.
Now, how much warning did you have when this came?
Well, we could see the storm clouds gathering. Ultimately, when we were told to leave, we only had 1 week notice. Now, I want to pause here a moment and give you the impact of that. Let's assume for a moment you are told today, 1 week from today, you've got to go somewhere. You don't know where, you don't know for how long, and you're told that all you can bring with you is what you can carry, your toothbrush, some clothes. What do you do about your dog? Well, that's a minimal factor. What about your goldfish? Well, we're not going to worry about. What about your car? We're not going to worry about that. Now, when you get to people who were in business, and a lot of them were in business, what about my crops? I have several hundred acres of strawberries. We're not going to worry about that. What about my tractor that I bought last year? We're not going to worry about that. What about my home? What about my farmland? What about all these things? We're not going to worry about that. You just be there 1 week from today with what you can carry. Where are you going? We can't tell you. How long? We can't tell you. Can you imagine the inhumanity of something like that being imposed upon American citizens?
When that order actually came out, was at that point there much of a cohesive community of Japanese Americans?
Not really, because I think we were all in a complete state of shock that our government would do this to its own based upon race. Complete shock.
Do you remember what your family did to prepare? You were 18 at the time, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I remember my parents, and I know a lot of other parents, did the same thing. If we had photographs from Japan, and look, name me an ethnic group that does not have photographs from the old country, whether it be Italy, Israel, Germany,
Russia,
whatever. They burned them all. Some people burned heirlooms because they thought that if they had them, they would be considered suspect. And I personally remember, for example, I had some pictures of a cruiser, U.S. cruiser. You know, what American boy who sees a cruiser, one of his own ships going through the waters, would think that's so great? And I happened to have a little box camera, and I took a photo of it. I remember those being burned. The reaction, those are the kinds of things we did.
How about books or newspapers? Because, you know, it's Japanese Americans spoke Japanese, which is a foreign language
okay.
in America.
Right. They even burned Bibles. I mean Bibles. Jesus Christ Bibles, which happened to be in Japanese. They burned Bibles in which I remember one instance where a Bible in the English language in which the reader apparently had made some notations in his native language, Japanese. He could read both Japanese and English. Those were burned because, you know, some FBI agent comes along and would read it and think that these are secret codes. The hysteria of it, the loss of any sense of perspective, the loss of any common sense and decency were just completely abandoned.
Did people take possessions that other than the bedding and the toothbrush and the clothing that they were allowed to bring, small things or things which were important because of family associations or heritage? Were people bringing those type of things?
Oh, I imagine there must have been some people who did. But the first thing you brought along was a survival kit. And as I mentioned to you before, people destroyed heirlooms. There were situations, incidentally, where people, rather than engage in distress sales, where somebody may offer you 10 cents on the dollar for something that is valuable, rather than face that kind of shame, I know of some instances where they just put in a big pile and set fire to it.
What would people do with their houses? I mean,
they had to abandon them. They tried to sell them at a distress sale if they could, and the vultures came from all around and tried to scavenge. In some instances, a neighbor would say, well, I'll take care of it for you. I'll harvest your crops for you. Well, yeah, they harvested it all right. They never got the money. The homes, if they came back to it, would be in shambles. Some of them were firebombed.
What was the reaction from neighbors that you did live with and all of a sudden are on another side of a fence, literally and figuratively?
Well, there were a number of the neighbors, Caucasians, who, of course, understood. They knew, say, me, my family, and understood that these folks are just good, decent, hardworking, law-abiding, loyal Americans. And so they were very understanding. But there are many, many others out there who are very ignorant and who had hate in their hearts, unfortunately.
What did parents tell their children, the Japanese-American parents, as a family is preparing to go to an internment camp?
They said very little, and let me explain why. Like any foreign stock, whether they're from Germany or European stock or from any other part of the world, our parents were hardworking, said very little, and they taught us, the children, to work hard, mind your own business, obey the laws, work and endure. And so when this tragedy, this great, awful tragedy befell us, they didn't have to tell us anything. We knew that this is what they expected us to do, to bear, to be patient, to hold up, and we'll somehow slug it through and see it through.
Were there parents that had to deal with, really legitimate fears or imagined fears of what was going to happen, from their children? Was there reassurance needed that, this is not forever, or this is not going to threaten your life? Or what was the sense of all that at that point?
No, I don't. My parents never conveyed anything like that to me. But I will say this: incidentally, at the time the war broke out, one of my brothers was already in the U.S. Army. He was a sergeant in the Air Force. That didn't mean a thing, by the way. Of course, we still were hauled off to the barbed wire camps. And this story can be multiplied by thousands. Didn't just happen to my family. My parents and many other parents told us, if they told us anything, you are American. You are American. Initially, whatever assurance they gave, and we ourselves believe this as American citizens, surely my own government would not do this to me, an American citizen. They might do a lot of other things which are unjust, but they wouldn't do it to a citizen. Unfortunately, we were wrong on that.
Was there resistance or discussion of resistance among either the younger generation or?
Well, I'll tell you, when someone has a gun to your head, whether it be a robber, and he says, hand me your money, you don't resist. When the U.S. government comes forth with tanks and soldiers with bayonets, helmets, steel helmets, and they say you're going to move, you move if you want to stay alive.
There was that tone of...
Oh, no question about it, authority. And as I say, my parents, all of our parents, were law-abiding citizens, and when the government tells you to do something, they did it, even though they complied, even though they knew in their hearts it was wrong. And as I say, we who may be a little bit more Americanized say, wait a minute, this thing is wrong. Nevertheless, if they have a bayonet and a gun, you have no choice.
What are your recollections of the camps when you'd spent 6 months?
Yes, I did.
In camp?
First of all, the camps were in desolate areas. They're dust. No, nothing growing there except sagebrush. There are no pavings. Mud. When it rained, it was mud up to your ankles. We were placed into tar paper barracks in a room approximately 20 by 25 for a whole family, sometimes two to a family. I remember when I first went in, there were two families, and we had to drape a sheet, just for some degree of privacy. The only thought that I recall being behind the barbed wire fences and being an American boy, and by the way, I happened to be editor-in-chief of my high school newspaper. I was once student body president. I saluted the flag and pledged allegiance every morning, and at least in those days we had to. And I looked behind from those barbaric camps and said, wait a minute. You know, there are German and Italian aliens. I'm not talking about German Americans or Italian Americans. We were at war with Italy and Germany as well. There were aliens who, for whatever reason, did not elect to become U.S. citizens, who were running around free on the other side of that barbed wire fence. And here I, an American, a true blue American, I'm on the wrong side of the fence with barbed wire fence, watchtowers, searchlights. And I knew then, surely, there is something basically grievously wrong with this setup.
Did you witness much violence when you were
there? I myself did not witness any violence. However, during the course of the hearings of the commission, of which, I, as you mentioned, I'm a member, there have been, I recall, approximately about a half a dozen shootings. One of them involved, for example, a man who was seeking to scavenge some boards on the other side of the fence, of the barbed wire fence. He was shot. Another involved a little boy who happened to see a puppy running on the other side of the fence. And look, you know, if you don't have any pets at all in camp and you're a boy, or even if, whatever, you see a little puppy running around, you're going to reach out for it. He did, and he was shot.
What was the effect on the family units of, you know, having to live in without privacy and in close quarters, I guess, with nothing to do all day, right?
That's correct. What it did, basically, it destroyed the family unit. This is one of the things, like many other immigrant stocks, we pride ourselves. The family unity. You had, you know, the father was the head of the family. He was the dictator. And if he said jump, you said how high. And that's the way it was. And you minded your parents. And the way that was held together is you sat down with your parents, you ate with your parents, you had to hand in your report card to your parents, you had to account to your parents. Once we got into camp, we no longer ate together because it was like an army mess hall. Everybody took off each their different way, ate at different mess halls. And as a result, this most important retention of the family unit was destroyed, and the discipline began to crumble.
Do you have much contact with the outside world?
None whatsoever.
What did you believe about the war effort at that point?
Well, I hoped that the United States would win, as did many thousands of us, notwithstanding all of the terrible situation in which our government had placed us.
Well, you entered the military. I believe
you
applied for the Navy, but ultimately weren't accepted. You served in the Army.
That's right.
Why weren't you accepted in the Navy, first of all?
Well, that's a little bit of a long story. All my classmates were volunteering. That is my Caucasian classmates. As I said, I left in about 6 months to go back to school. And so, you know, like any other American, I figured, well, I'll volunteer too. You know, this is my war just as much as anybody else's war, and my country's threatened. So I volunteered, and I wanted to fight in the Naval Air Corps. So I applied. And with my name, Maritani, which sounds Italian, the application continued to be processed. The one thing I lacked, however, was my birth certificate, because I didn't take a birth certificate when I was uprooted. And I wrote back to the state of Washington, where I was born, and got my birth certificate, and finally sent up that last piece of document. In the meantime, by the way, the Navy was almost sending me letters every week saying, hurry up, because they wanted fighter pilots, and I was willing to go. Soon as they got my birth certificate and saw my parents, who my parents were, of my race, they sent all my papers back. And after that, well, I figured, well, what else can I do? And by the way, I was then classified 4C, I think it was, or 4E, I forgot which it was at the moment, which means an alien. An alien.
Mm-hmm.
Can you
mm-hmm.
imagine
mm-hmm.
an American citizen?
And you were born in America.
Yeah, an American citizen categorically being classified as an alien.
Well, when you went to Japan in the Army, it is a little hard to believe that you could go to what is the land of your ancestry after being interned by America and fight in the American Army against Japan without a lot of conflict, a lot of internal conflict.
No conflict at all whatsoever, any more than German Americans fought against Hitler. So I was willing to fight against Tojo, and about 8,000 of us did in the Pacific.
Uh-huh. How did you react to the anti-Japanese sentiment of your fellow soldiers? you know, in terms of fighting the Japs in Japan. How did you react to that? Because, you know, that might not have been making the distinction between ancestry and citizenship.
Actually, once you get into a unit, there's very little of that. Your buddies know you. They know what you are. They know which way you're pointing.
People were sensitive to that?
That was no problem. That was no problem.
How did the Japanese regard you? That is, the Japanese residents of Japan who you were there to fight? Or to
yes, frankly, I thought that there might be some hostility on their part, seeing a Japanese face in an American uniform who obviously had fought against their own country, that is Japan, fought against the Japanese. But there was none of that. They seemed to understand, and indeed, they viewed me as an American, apparently without any conditions whatsoever. And by the way, I happen to be a military intelligence officer, so I studied Japanese in the U.S. Army and could speak, read, and write Japanese. So when I went over there as an American officer, first of all, I might back up and tell you that the children in Japan referred to me solely as an American, Amerikanjin, they kept calling me, Amerikanjin. And as you know, children are beyond guile. They will tell it like it is. So they viewed me, this told me that the Japanese viewed me as an American. I remember one time I was working under MacArthur's headquarters, and we conducted a raid in Osaka, Japan, thinking that maybe the Japanese militarists still had some arms hidden away. And there was a superintendent of this munitions factory, and I went up to him and spoke to him in Japanese as to certain information. And he was absolutely flabbergasted that an American officer, even though with a Japanese face, could speak Japanese. And he said, "Would you please come home with me?" And I said, "What for?" He said, "I want my wife to meet you." He wanted to show me off that here was an American officer, an American soldier who could speak Japanese.
How did you react when the children would call you an American?
That's the truth. I reacted as an American. Fine. Yes.
Were you regarded, though, as being a traitor to Japan?
No, none. I never ran into that. If there was any sentiment like that, it was never manifested. Not at any time.
Let's get back to talking about when people left the internment camps. I guess around 1945 was when the internment camps started to open. And people could return to their homes.
It was a little bit earlier than that, but yes.
Well, were people prepared to leave? I mean, to enter a larger world of...
No. Let me put you in a situation. Let's assume that we today put you in a camp, suitcase, toothbrush, et cetera, all right? Your home you've lost, your tractor you've lost, your farmland you've lost, and now they say we're going to let you out. It's in a hostile world yet. They haven't gotten over it. They say, all right, go out and hustle for yourself, friend. Can you be prepared? You have now been institutionalized to some extent. My parents were now deprived of all the things that they had worked for so long, for so many years, and now suddenly being cut free. They had not saved up any money during the war years. While others were working in war plants and making money hand over fist, they were being paid if they worked at all. And by the way, the pay scale in the camps were $12 a month, $16 a month, and $19 a month. That comes out to about 75 cents a day at the maximum. You can't save anything with that. Even if you saved it all, you'd have practically nothing. Now you're cut loose and say, all right, fend for yourself. Are you prepared? Absolutely not.
How about although the camps were opened and people could go home, they're still entering the same world which had locked them up 3 years ago. How was that hostility anticipated by the people who are returning to?
Oh, you mean the people who were, say, in California?
Right. How did the people who were leaving the camps anticipate the wider world that they were returning to?
With a great deal of uncertainty, a great deal of reservation, and with some degree of fear, all of which were justified. You know, there were shootings and firebombings, signs in California and elsewhere. No Japs wanted. They're still insisting on Japs. I mean, we who had served in the U.S. Army, there's a story of Senator Dan Inouye, who lost his arm in Italy fighting. And my brother, incidentally, another brother, also went into the... There were three of us who were in the Army, including myself. You know, here you are in a United States uniform, a veteran, fought to save this country, and you come back and you can't get a haircut. Can you imagine? In your own land, you can't get a haircut. That's what happened to Senator Inouye. And there are many, many, many other indignities like that that we faced.
Well, right now there's across the country a series of hearings and meetings with people who are demanding reparations. Can you briefly sort of can you summarize what reparations are being sought and why now, 40 years after, is this coming up at this point?
Let me first of all start off with the why 40 years later. When we were placed into the camps, that is not something to be proud of. There is a stigma attached to that. There's an implication that you were disloyal, even though it is absolutely untrue. In fact, we went out and proved our loyalty, as no Americans have. By the way, for example, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which is a unit comprised solely of Japanese Americans, came out of the war in Europe as being the most decorated unit in all the annals of American military history, beginning with the Civil War, for size of unit and length of service, for example. So we had really proved our loyalty, if any American has to prove their loyalty, and they shouldn't have to. But we did. As I mentioned to you before, 8,000 of us served in the Pacific against Japan. So we proved our loyalty. There's no question about that. But nevertheless, being thrown in summarily like a common criminal, and there was no charge against us whatsoever. As I mentioned to you before, J. Edgar Hoover said there's reported not a single instance of espionage or sabotage. But nevertheless, we were thrown into camps. It is a little bit like a rape victim. You've been raped, and we were raped. Believe me, we were raped. And God Almighty, that they raped my parents as well. You know, if they raped me, somehow I'll survive. But they should not have raped my parents. And it is very hard to say I've been raped, that I was a rape victim. And it takes a long while to get over that. And after you mature and after you reflect and you say, you know, something dastardly was done to us. And somebody should respond to it. Our government committed a grievous wrong. Somebody should respond.
What's being asked of reparations? How?
Well, various figures are thrown around, tossed about, I should say. One of them is $25,000 per person that they incarcerated. That, incidentally, comes to $3 billion. That only shows you the magnitude of the of this gross injustice perpetrated on these people. And I don't think that the Nisei, the Japanese Americans, are so much interested in money. I know I'm not, and I'm not going to take a penny if the government offers it to me, because nobody can buy my liberty. Nobody can pay me for what they did. I'm not bitter about it. I'm still, as you know, I'm a judge, and I have to accept the past for what it is. But nobody has ever said, the government has never said, we were wrong. We were wrong. Now, in our society, the only way that you indicate that you were wrong, whether you breach a contract, commit an act of negligence against another, breach the antitrust laws, or commit a crime, one of the ways is by money. We no longer go eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, okay? So that's the medium. That's the way we, in our society, we acknowledge a wrong. And that is simply what is being sought. I would hope that whatever money they receive will go along to help, if they receive any, that is. And that would go along to help the elderly, the infirm, scholarships, etc. But again, I repeat, I myself will not take a penny.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk. Unfortunately, we are out of time. But thank you for coming here.
Not at all. My pleasure.
We've spent the last 40 minutes or so speaking with Judge William Muratani, who is a judge in the Common Pleas Court in Philadelphia, and he's very active in the Japanese American Citizens League on their National Committee for Redress, and also on the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. We've, of course, been talking about the internment of over 120,000 Japanese Americans during World War II on the West Coast. Thanks again for being here.
Not all. I do want to make one correction. I'm not on the National Committee for Redress. I'm just simply on the commission.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Sorry.
Well, Again, thanks for coming today. Not at all.